the ideas, the leaders, the lives that are shaping Denmark and the world. From Blocks Hub in Copenhagen, Denmark, this is Global Denmark.
Welcome back to the Global Denmark podcast, where we explore how thought leaders and innovators are working to create a better Denmark and a better world. Well, we are back after our little mini two-week holiday, and I am fresh, energized, and ready to go. We had a wonderful conversation recently with Tim Clark, who is a world-renowned expert on psychological safety. You know, I was really curious, how could a country like Denmark improve in the areas of integration, inclusion, and innovation? And Tim was just the guy to get on the podcast to explore these questions with me. Tim is the founder and CEO of Leader Factor, a consultancy firm that focuses on leadership development, organizational change, strategic agility, emotional intelligence, among other things. He's also the developer of the EQometer assessment and the four stages of psychological safety training program. Tim earned a doctorate from Oxford University, is a former two-time CEO, author of 5 books, and more than 130 articles on various aspects of leadership and performance. Tim works with leading organizations across industries and advises a number of executive teams on large-scale change and transformation projects. In our conversation, we take a deep dive into his new book that just came out here in 2020 called The 4 Stages of Psychological Safety, Defining the Path for Inclusion and Innovation. We break down these 4 stages, how to truly draw out the benefits of diversity, and ultimately how organizations and societies can achieve the requisite psychological safety to create the innovation that is critical for success moving forward. So without further ado, we bring you Tim Clark. All right, we are back with today's special guest, Tim Clark, calling in from Salt Lake City, Utah. Tim, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great, Thomas. Thanks for having me.
It's a true pleasure. I must say, when I found out about your new book, The 4 Stages of Psychological Safety, I thought, okay, I got to have a conversation with this guy, and I really appreciate you calling in with the time difference too. I know what time is it where you are right now?
Oh, it's 11:45. It's almost noon, so it's perfect time here.
All right. Yeah, we're almost 8:00 here in the evening, so okay, that works out.
Oh yeah.
How's everything going over there? I know with the COVID situation in the States, and as we're recording this, there's the protests that are sweeping the nation. I mean, what's going on for our listeners over in the States right now?
Plenty. We got a lot going on, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, as far as COVID-19, it really depends on where you are geographically in the States. You've got hot spots, you've got places where the virus has accelerated, and then you have other places that are pretty quiet, and that's where we are. We're in a place where it's pretty quiet. Matter of fact, our office is across the street from a hospital, and the hospital is quiet. It's incredibly quiet and always has been. So we're fortunate. We hope that we have flattened the curve and that we don't see a spike.
Yeah.
And then as you and I were talking earlier, Thomas, the protests have been widespread across the country in almost all of the major metro areas.
Yep.
And I just really think that the moral outrage that people have felt concerning what's happened is something that it's just, we have more systemic bias in our society than we thought we did. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us thought we had made more progress than perhaps we have. And so this is a great moment of introspection. And we're just doing, an inventory at a societal level, and I think we realize that we've got work to do.
I think that's a great way of putting it, as a kind of an opportunity for growth and introspection. And I really hope to see the society grow from this experience and not to kind of regress in a way.
I'll share with you, Thomas, one of the principles that I talk about in the book when we talk about inclusion in stage 1 is the principle that worth precedes worthiness. And I think this is a very important principle. Worth means that you have inherent or intrinsic worth as a human being. And my very strong point of view on this is that this is a human right, that we have a moral obligation to invite each other into our respective societies by virtue of the fact that we're human. So if you're human and you're harmless, then I really owe you that. So that inclusion safety, which I call stage one, I believe anyway, is owed. It's not earned. And so when we connect this to instances of racial bias, we can't justify that on any grounds. There are no grounds to justify that because, well, we can go back to the statement of the great social reformer Frederick Douglass, who said that I know of no rights of race that are superior to the rights of humanity. Now, that's a very important statement because what he's saying is that if you're part of the human family, then you're entitled to those rights, and those rights supersede any other rights attached to a demographic or a psychographic or a geography, including race and any other characteristic that you might want to talk about. And so when we see, again, violence or mistreatment or exploitation based on race, there's absolutely no justification. And then I talk about what I call junk theories of superiority.
Yeah.
We've been governing ourselves and our societies for millennia based on junk theories of superiority. We try to justify notions of superiority. We try to tell ourselves soothing stories to elevate ourselves and subordinate others. Well, they're junk theories because they're all patently false.
Right.
And so the treatment of this African-American gentleman is just, there are millions of us that we just can't comprehend that. And we are outraged. We are embarrassed that this has taken place in our society. We thought we had graduated. We thought we had overcome some of this. But obviously, there's a lot of it that still lingers, and we're sad about it.
Yeah, you know what? It's amazing. I saw, I think, a tweet where a woman had a poster where she held up, said, "I'm 66 years old. I can't believe I'm still protesting this crap."
That's right.
And I thought that spoke to just, we thought we graduated, but here we are still, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like enough already. And so it goes back to the principle, worth precedes worthiness. Now, do we measure performance in worthiness at some point? Sure, we do. But not when it comes to accepting each other. Worthiness comes later. That's a separate discussion that comes after the issue of worth. And so we all live and work in a hyper-competitive environment, and we are measured and we are judged based on aspects of performance or worthiness, and that's okay. But as far as the inherent or intrinsic worth of human beings, that's not in question. That's the difference. We can have those worthiness discussions when it comes to performance, and that's fine.
Right. But it's the intrinsic human value that is the bridge to actually getting into the inclusion realm. Without it, it's just a society and organization that's predicated upon exclusion. Is that right?
It is. It is. And so the barriers that we create are invalid. They're illegitimate barriers. You know, the borders that we create between and among ourselves based on demographic characteristics, based on psychographic characteristics. I mean, I've lived in Europe. I've lived in Asia. I grew up in Colorado and then California. So I was a West Coast kid in LA and then the Bay Area. And then my wife and I, we moved to the East Coast. We lived in the Washington, D.C. area. So we've covered some territory.
Yeah, I would say. Yeah.
We've covered some territory. And it really is a little surprising that we're still talking about this and that this is an issue. And it must just go back to the universal condition of insecurity that seems to plague the human species, because otherwise, you know, this is just silly. We shouldn't be talking about this anymore.
No. You know, as you were saying, I really hope this is an opportunity for introspection and growth.
Yes, I do too.
Well, Tim, I am just so happy that I came across your work. And for our audience, again, this is a book that just came out, and it's called The Four Stages of Psychological Safety. And it's just a fantastic read if you're in the diversity and inclusion field, especially. I think it's a must read. Tim, I just want to know, why this book and why now?
Well, what my firm does is we work with a lot of technology companies that have to innovate in order to survive. Innovation is their lifeblood. And if they don't innovate, then they're not going to be around very long. A lot of Silicon Valley technology companies. And what we have found is that it mirrors some of the other studies. These companies, and this happens in many organizations, they assemble teams of very talented people to innovate. And yet, oftentimes, these teams cannot innovate because they can't work together. Mm-hmm. And we've always known that culture, the culture of a team or an organization, is either an enabler or an inhibitor to performance. We've always known that. But what we didn't know is how profoundly true this is. Mm-hmm. And with psychological safety as a research construct goes back to 1965, when a couple of professors at MIT, Edgar Schein and Warren Bennis, coined the term. And it's only been just in recent years that we've had a lot of empirical research come out that helps us understand the unbelievably strong connection between psychological safety and innovation. And so that psychological safety is literally, well, I shouldn't say literally, it's a metaphor, but it is the lubricating oil for collaboration. Mm. If the team members cannot work together effectively, they can't innovate. And here's why. Because if you don't feel safe in a setting, in a social setting, then fear will trigger what we call the self-censoring instinct. So you'll self-censor yourself. You'll retreat. You'll recoil into a mode of personal risk management and self-preservation and loss avoidance. That's what you're going to do. And in that mode, you've been thrust into this mode of playing defense. You're not playing offense anymore because you're trying to manage your own personal risk. Right. So if you have a team and the individuals on that team, if their self-censoring instinct has been activated, they are not going to engage and take risks and expose themselves personally in vulnerable situations, which is what innovation requires. They're not going to do that. And so what's happened basically, Thomas, is that the research has caught up with the intuition. We now know very, very clearly that without psychological safety, you are handicapped as a team and as an organization, and you cannot compete with organizations that have high psychological safety. You're just not going to be competitive.
Yeah, and this is an established fact now. I mean, what was it? Google's Aristotle Project, and I think you mentioned off air the Microsoft Art of Teams
That's right.
report.
That's right.
And their major conclusions were just buffering what your thesis is, that psychological safety is the key issue in terms of maximizing team performance and innovation.
That's right. That's right. Because here's the way that I put it in the book. A fear-stricken team will give you their hands. They will give you some of their head, and they will give you none of their heart. Why? Because they're not safe. Now, think about what that means in terms of performance and in terms of innovation. You are not getting their discretionary efforts. You're getting compliance. You're not getting commitment. And so you're going to compete on that basis. So what we have found essentially is that if you don't have high levels of psychological safety, nothing else can compensate for not having that. There's nothing else you can do. You can be exquisitely blessed with vision and strategy and guidance and direction and resources and expertise and knowledge and skills and technology. That's great. But if you don't have the psychological safety, you can't bring it all together.
Right. And I think you put it very well in your book where you said, "I see uncritical celebrations of diversity everywhere, but diversity produces nothing and blesses no one unless its value can be drawn out." And I think, you know, I hear it and work with it a lot that people talk about, okay, we just hit this quota with X amount of women in this position or have this cultural diversity, or we look at this age diversity, just looking at diversity devoid of the underlying psychological mechanism for what drives innovation. And I can see that you're saying this is a fatal flaw because diversity isolated means nothing in terms of innovation.
That's right. The way that I like to distinguish it, Thomas, is that diversity is compositional. So diversity refers to the makeup of your team or your organization. And even if you don't have diversity in several different categories, you will at a minimum always have cognitive diversity. Mm-hmm. That's always going to be an operating fact for any team. And then we can add other characteristics of diversity, but it's still compositional. So the question becomes, how do you harness that diversity? How do you bring it into service? Mm-hmm. That's where we get into inclusion, because while diversity is compositional, inclusion is attitudinal, it's moral, and it's behavioral. That's a different thing. The reason that I say that I see all these uncritical celebrations of diversity and I'm not very impressed with it is because organizations across the board, at least here, have made huge gains and they've taken big steps in improving the composition of their mm-hmm. teams and organizations. So diversity, they've improved diversity. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But many of them are high-centered. They are stuck in being able to create deeply inclusive environments. They're not doing very well with that, because in order to do that, now we get into belief and behavior.
Yeah.
And so this takes us to the discussion of what is the traditional approach to diversity and inclusion. And mm-hmm. I can tell you that based on all of our accumulated client experience, the traditional approach is you begin at one end of the spectrum. You begin with awareness of differences, then you progress to understanding of differences, and then you progress to appreciation of differences. Okay, that's fine. But where they run into the wall is they can't cross over mm-hmm. to belief and behavior. So there's a threshold. So after we have awareness, after we have understanding, after we have appreciation, we have to cross over what I call a threshold of conviction, which then takes us to belief and behavior. If we never get to belief and behavior, then this whole exercise is compliance.
Right, because at some fundamental level, you have to rewire the cognition in your brain to elicit that behavioral change, whether it's at the individual level or organizationally. Precisely. Otherwise, it is just, like you said, that exercise. It's really fascinating. I mean, let me give you an example. You know, we're here in Copenhagen in Denmark, and one of the greatest attributes of the Danish society is the notion of trust. It's a very high trust-based society, which is a major asset. But what we can see is that trust is very much predicated upon a common understanding through hundreds of years of the implicit rules of society and how it's governed in a very tribalistic mentality. So that very trust that is such an asset amongst people that are part of the game is a huge barrier for people coming in from the outside mm-hmm. and leads to exclusion. What are your kind of basic thoughts and intuitions when you hear that? Obviously, you're not in Denmark, but we hear this throughout the Nordics, this kind of conundrum.
Well, I'll share an interesting anecdote with you, Thomas. So my mother comes from a Danish family. Her maiden name was Christofferson.
Okay, yeah.
And so this is quite interesting, because my great-grandfather emigrated from Denmark. His name was Peter Julius Christofferson. He came from Denmark and he came to the United States and he settled in Utah, which is where I live now. Mm-hmm. And we have some of his journal and some journal from his wife and children. And they talk about integrating here, right? And mm-hmm. what that was like and how it wasn't easy. And so it's just ironic that we're talking about this. So that trust is, I think, in Danish society, which is such an egalitarian society, is based on the foundation that you already have in place based on the homogeneity of the society. And so if you're talking about accelerating the integration process, then I think the outreach has to go to the next level. Mm-hmm. So that means that, so for example, I'll give you an example. So one of the things that we do in an organizational setting to accelerate integration when we onboard new employees is we do what's called hop-on, hop-off interviews. So for example, if you've traveled in big cities across the world, they have these hop-on, hop-off buses.
Yep.
And you can, you know, the tourists get on these buses and they ride to see the major tourist attractions. They get off, they'll take a look at an attraction, they'll get back on the bus. So in a similar manner, what we do in organizations is when we have new employees coming on board, we give them hop on, hop off interviews where they will literally in a day, they will have short interviews with lots of people in that organization. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to expedite, we're trying to accelerate the pace of this process, because naturally it happens sometimes way too slowly. Mm-hmm. So we try to accelerate that. And what we say is, you've got 10 minutes with Thomas. You're going to sit down with Thomas and you're going to get to know each other. And there's three things that we want you to do. We want you to ask. So we're going to give you three verbs. We want you to ask, we want you to share, and we want you to invite. Now you determine how you're going to apply those three verbs, but you've got 10 minutes. Focus on asking, sharing, and inviting. And I got to tell you, Thomas, it is incredible what you can do if you accelerate the natural pace of some of these processes. So literally, in a week, the social and cultural integration that we can achieve with a new employee that's onboarding is astonishing. We can accomplish sometimes in a week what it takes normally, like in a year. So that's just an example that I thought you might find interesting.
And that's pivotal too, because, you know, once the honeymoon period goes away and culture shock starts to set in, you know, that's where voluntary turnover spikes. So if you can accelerate that process, the retention of talent, I can imagine it's a great benefit for the company for sure.
It really is.
So Tim, let's break down the book a little bit. You mentioned the stage one, you know, the book is about four stages to achieving psychological safety. You mentioned stage one as this inclusion safety based on the intrinsic worth of human beings.
Yep.
that you owe human beings inclusion due to the fact that they are a human being.
That's right.
So that seems like that every organization or society should be capable of achieving that.
True. That's the foundation, and that's where we have to start. And that's the moral foundation.
Where do we go from there? I know that in your book, stage two is something called learner safety. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. So learner safety is stage two. We build it on the foundation of inclusion safety. And learner safety means that you feel safe to engage in the learning process. What does that mean? That means that you can ask questions. You can give and receive feedback. You can experiment. You can make mistakes, all without fear of being embarrassed or marginalized or punished in some way. And so you can see that when you're learning, so this follows the pattern of natural human needs. So the first impulse and the first instinct that humans have when they come into new social collectives is they want to be included. They want to be accepted. They want to belong. So that's why inclusion safety is the foundation. After that, they want to engage in the learning process. They want to grow and develop.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a little more risk there, because in stage one inclusion safety, I just need to be human. I just need to be me. And hopefully it's not expensive to be myself. If it's not expensive, then I do have inclusion safety. But in stage two learner safety, I have to expose myself in the learning process. And that's not easy, because we all bring some inhibition and risk to the learning process. So the social exchange in stage two is, if you will encourage my learning, I will engage in the learning. So that's the social exchange. Encourage in exchange for engagement. But here's the important point. If you're a leader, if you're a manager, if you represent an institution or an organization, your stewardship is to act first. You have to act first. You have to be the first mover. And the example that I give in the book, Thomas, is that, for example, in the United States, a student drops out of high school every 26 seconds. If you dig into that to understand why that's happening, it's not because they can't do the academic work. Barring some legitimate learning disability, they can do the academic work. What's happened is, and this verifies cognitive psychology research, which says that the learning process is a combination of an intellectual process and an emotional process. Mm. You can never separate those two. So the students that drop out, they are emotionally bruised. They've been emotionally hurt. They don't feel the support. They don't feel that they have the support. And so eventually, without that, they drop out. They call it quits. So learner safety is not a purely, we deceive ourselves when we say, oh, you know, learning is purely intellectual. No, it's not. Never has been. It's a deeply emotional process. So we have to provide support for that. And you can see this, even adults don't act really very differently than children. They just hide it better.
That's
so
right.
So if a new employee comes to work on a team, what are they concerned about? First of all, do I fit in? And then number two, if I take learning risks, will those acts of learning vulnerability be punished or rewarded? So that's stage two.
To be clear then, in an organization, we're looking at a kind of an asymmetric power dynamic where it's the people that are already there, the dominant organizational employees or in the society that need to take the first step. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I am. That's exactly what I'm saying, because very often the people that need to learn, the people that have come into the organization, they don't have the confidence, nor do they feel the permission. And so the institution needs to be the first mover to get that process going and to establish that learner safety.
Now, do you see when you work with organizations, this mentality, this invitation in for learner safety, does it have to be rooted up in the executive suite, or can it just be a middle management initiative?
No, it can be local, because the most profound culture in institutions is what we call the microculture, and that exists at the level of a team. And so the dynamics, the interpersonal dynamics that matter the most are between the new team member and his or her manager and colleagues on that team. And so it's really the local interpersonal dynamics at the team level that have the most profound effect on that individual. Regardless of what's taking place in other parts of the organization, that's going to matter the most. Now, is that affected by what happens at the top? Absolutely, because the leaders at the top, they set the tone, and they have the most influence in creating the prevailing norms for that institution. But that can also be buffered by the local leader that is managing a local team.
That's really interesting here. And, you know, on the societal level outside of the organization, I can see this kind of in the way that expats integrate. We have the traditional expat bubble where it's a safe bubble for expats to be able to feel that inclusion safety that they long for as a human being, where maybe they don't feel that invitation in from the society in which they live. And I can see now that what you're saying is if they just get that invitation, that push, and then they themselves are a little bit vulnerable to meet that invitation, then they can grow and develop in that new context.
That's right. But I would also say, Thomas, and I'm sure that this is true between the Danish society and the expat community, and that is that Danish society also has some trepidation in reaching out to people or reaching out to immigrants. And so we have to understand that too. It goes both ways. And I think both sides have to be courageous and compassionate in that process.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. And that's what we work for. You know, you do see this trepidation, and in the Nordics, there is kind of a social reluctance to invite foreigners into the trust circle. And, you know, you hear a lot of the time that we're very, as a Dane or a Swede or a Norwegian, standoffish at first. But once you are a friend, you're a friend for life. So it's like this guarding test to come in. But I think that notion needs to be challenged from what you're saying through learner safety, that if you're in a dominant position, that there needs to be kind of an olive branch that is given by one side to start the dialogue.
And that's an act of vulnerability on either side.
Yep.
But I think it needs to happen. That reminds me, let me just give you another interesting anecdote. So when I was in college, I took a football scholarship to Brigham Young University, and I played college football. Yep. When I was in the dormitories as a freshman with some of my football buddies, we had a couple of weeks into the school year, two Nordics move in. We had a hammer thrower that moved in from Finland, We had a discus thrower that moved in from Sweden. These were big, strong guys. They kept to themselves initially, but then we broke through the barriers. And I'm telling you, those guys, they become loyal friends for life. It's incredible. They were incredible people. And so I kind of went through that as a college student, and I gained that appreciation. And I can just see the trepidation that we had and they had, but it didn't take too much. And then this beautiful friendship and this integration started, and it worked.
That is a perfect microcosm for what we see over here. And, you know, it's rooted in a lot of the times in the schooling system, from an early age, for 10 years, from kindergarten through grade 9, which is where lower secondary ends here, they have the same classmates. So a huge emphasis is placed on collaboration and building up trust within this dynamic. But then it closes the circle. You know, you're not as agile and adaptive maybe as if you're switching every year and put into different scenarios.
Yeah.
So we achieve learner safety. What's the move then into the third stage?
Third stage is what we call contributor safety. And this again follows the pattern of natural human need. So you have been through learner safety. You've learned, you've acquired skills, knowledge, competency. The natural human desire is to go use and apply what you have learned. So contributor safety means that you feel safe to contribute as a full-fledged member of the team, to make a difference and participate in the value creation process, whatever it is that you're doing. So the contributor safety means that you can do that again without ridicule, without embarrassment, and you have autonomy in that process. What do people need in that process? They need autonomy, they need encouragement, they need guidance. Mm-hmm. So the social exchange in that stage is autonomy and the guidance and the encouragement in exchange for results. We actually need results. So you can see that in stage 3, contributor safety, the performance requirement, there is a performance requirement for the individual. You have to deliver.
Yeah.
You have to become competent. You have to hold yourself accountable, and you have to deliver. Now, that's far different than, as we go back to stage 1, inclusion safety, where your performance requirement is be human and be harmless. Mm-hmm. And then your performance requirement for learner safety is engage in the learning process. Well, now we get to contributor safety, and people expect you to carry your water.
Yeah.
They expect you to be able to get the job done.
Yeah.
And that expectation is completely valid.
So should this be something explicitly stated by a manager that, hey, look, I want to give you the autonomy to show me what you've got now. I think you're ready. Or does that need to come from the employee and say, I want the chance to prove my value. I'm ready.
Well, that's an interesting question, Thomas, because with the millennials these days, they have incredible expectations about coming in and contributing and making a difference right away.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that members of older generations kind of smile, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes don't like that very much. But I think ambiguity is not our friend. So I think the institution has a responsibility to always clarify expectations. Expectations change. We work and live in very dynamic environments, but I think it's always the institutional responsibility to lay out the expectations, to define the parameters of performance and the standards of performance. And then if they change, it's an ongoing dialogue. If you're in the employ of an organization, then I think that organization needs to help set you up for success as much as possible. Still, there will be questions and there will be uncertainty and ambiguity around things. But to the extent possible, I think we need to strive for that.
It makes a lot of sense. Going back to the millennials too, I think I understand why that the older employees would smile a little bit, because it's almost a tiny bit audacious to try to hop over the entire learning process and go right to challenging status quo immediately.
It is. And so it's kind of funny, the generational interface these days, because millennials are pretty impatient and they want to get in and make a difference. And the boomers are looking at them like, who do you think you are? And as we all know, permission rights in an organization are granted based on a demonstrated track record and credibility over time. And the millennials are saying, no, I'm not interested in that. I just want to, let's get going.
You can see the dynamic, the dilemma. Yeah, absolutely. So that contributor safety, we're still not at the level of what you refer to as the level of innovation, though. Is that correct?
Right. That's true.
So how do you then create innovation, you know, in teams and organizations? How do you get to that fourth and final step?
Sure. So let's just think, and I'll put this question to all of your listeners, and that is, what are the cultural requirements to create an incubator of innovation? Just think about that for a minute. What are the cultural requirements? So here's what we have found. We have found that you have to go to another level of psychological safety. This is stage 4. We call it challenger safety. Challenger safety is the highest level of psychological safety. It's the culmination. It's as high as you can get. And the reason that it needs to be is because innovation by its very nature is disruptive of the status quo. It requires that members of the team be able to challenge the status quo without jeopardizing their personal standing or reputation. Think about the level of vulnerability that you have to get to challenge the status quo. We're going to hold court on the status quo. We're going to look for ways to improve. We're looking for flaws. We're looking for problems. We're looking for mistakes.
Yeah.
This is a hard thing to do. And so it requires this highest level. It requires, so the interpersonal dynamic for innovation is what we call, so we use terms like creative abrasion, constructive dissent, the collision of ideas, hard-hitting debate and dialogue. That is how innovation happens. Innovation, for the most part, at its root, is a social process. Once in a while, you'll have someone that has a light bulb moment of lone genius, but that's the exception, right? Most innovation is social. It happens at the intersection of human beings that are working together.
Yeah, it's these diverse creative potentialities coming together and finding something that hasn't been thought of before.
That's right.
Now, you talk about in your book about two types of friction, kind of dovetails with what you're saying. Maybe you could say a word about that.
Sure. So the leader's job to nurture and cultivate that innovation, to create that culture that will support it. The leader's job is to simultaneously increase intellectual friction, meaning the hard-hitting dialogue, and at the same time, lower the social friction. So intellectual friction has to go up. Social friction has to come down. That is an indicator that you have an extremely effective leader. And the reason that we need to achieve that is because if the social friction is allowed to rise with the intellectual friction, at some point that social friction will hijack the process. It will shut down the intellectual friction. Because humans are sensitive. When we're working together, we're throwing out ideas, we're questioning, we are making suggestions, we may be challenging. If that interpersonal dynamic, if that dialogue, if it is allowed to wander into the personal arena and people take offense, then it's going to shut down the intellectual friction process. And then we're at impasse. We're not making progress anymore.
Yeah. And that's where kind of the cognitive biases will rear their head in a negative way.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, we're talking about a concrete case now. Let's say we have organization X here in Copenhagen that they think they've achieved stage 1, and that's great. How can they systematically then get to stage 4? What's kind of the basic recipe and the timeline as a top leadership team want to go in this direction?
Right. So you've got to try to baseline where you are, and then you're on a journey to move through the stages. So we have created what we call the behavioral guide, which is a very concrete how-to guide that teams and institutions can use. And it's a free download that is available on the website. Basically, what we have found, Thomas, is that what most teams have to do is they have to be able to identify patterns, behavioral patterns on the team, in the team, that have to change. And they have to do an inventory to try to identify patterns that trigger or activate the self-censoring instinct. If you don't get down to concrete behavioral issues, chances are you're not going to make the progress. You can't speak about it at a broad level or a general level or a philosophical level, it's never going to happen. It's got to be a concrete discussion about how do we push the fear button? How do we do that? What is it that makes you recoil? What is it that draws you out? We've got to understand our team dynamics very, very well. And by the way, then we do have the Four Stages Team Survey as well, which is an online platform that teams can use too.
Excellent. Well, I think we could probably talk all day about this, but for the sake of the podcast, I think this would be a great time to take a quick break, Tim, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
And then we will come back with our quickfire round to wrap up the podcast today.
Studying for an executive MBA at Henley Business School in Denmark is an intense and rewarding experience. If you want to achieve the best possible outcomes in business and in life, Henley can give you the skills and knowledge you need through the Henley MBA. For more information, visit henley.dk.
All right, we are back with today's special guest, Tim Clark, and we are going to dive into our quickfire round now. Tim, what habits, routines, or rituals do you do every day to stay mentally or physically sharp?
Mentally or physically sharp? Well, I read and I do a little bit of exercise. I spend time with my wife and I pray. I'm a prayerful person and try to watch what I eat. So they're very little things, but I find that those little habits really do compound over time. Mm-hmm. And the compounding effect is very real in life, even though sometimes we don't see it if we're just taking a snapshot in time. But so I think I'm a man of very simple habits. I like to greet the day early and get invigorated with those things.
Now, do you read nonfiction, fiction? Is there any particular genre that gets you in the right place mentally?
I read mostly nonfiction, and I think that my favorite genre would be biography.
Okay.
I love to read biographies.
Do you have a favorite one or two?
Well, I'm always reading. I've always got some going at the same time, at least a couple going at the same time. I've been reading one on Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese leader that has been really quite interesting. One of my favorites has been John Adams. I read another one on General George C. Marshall not long ago that I thought was pretty phenomenal. So I just love biography because we can go a little bit deeper to understand people's motivations and their values. And so I find that there's a big return on investment if it's a good biography.
Absolutely. The John Adams one, was that Ray Chernow who did that one as well? Or is that a different
one? No, that was David McCulloch.
Okay. Oh, excellent. Tim, have you ever undergone any one event or experience that you would credit with a major leap forward in your performance or the person you've become?
Yes. So this will be unflattering to me personally, but I share it at that risk. So when I was in graduate school at Oxford, when I was finishing my PhD, after 5 years, you have one last step, and that is you've got to go defend your dissertation. Mm-hmm. And you have to do that in a what's called a verbal defense. Yep. So you sit before your examiners and they question you. And so here's what happened to me. You'll see why I'm sharing this, Thomas. So after 5 years of work and research, I finished the dissertation and my advisor said to me, Tim, congratulations, you're done. You've got your verbal defense and don't worry about that. It's perfunctory. It's kind of more ceremonial than anything. Just enjoy the experience.
Take your victory lap.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic. So the way Oxford does this is it's very traditional. You have to wear your black robes. And so I still remember going into Nuffield College and sitting down in front of my examiners, and they proceeded to examine me quite vigorously for a couple of hours. And I was surprised at how difficult it was. It was very challenging and difficult. So after that, they excused me out of the room and they discussed things, I suppose. And then they invited me to come back in and they informed me that I had not passed the oral exam.
Oh my goodness.
And I was shattered. And that's an understatement. because here I was expecting that this was going to be kind of a routine thing.
Right.
So I was shattered. And by this time, my wife and I, we had moved back to the States. So I'll never forget walking out into the dreary English weather that night.
Yeah, that doesn't
calling
help.
Her and saying, Tracy, they didn't pass me. I failed the exam. They want another chapter on this. They want more statistical analysis on that. And I was absolutely crushed. That was kind of one of the most difficult defining experiences of my life, Thomas, because I had to pick myself up and I put in another full year of research and study. Wow. And then I came back and successfully completed the doctorate. It was a blindside for me. It was just a blindside. It was a shock to the system, unlike anything that I have ever experienced. What I learned from that, more than anything else, it wasn't about IQ points that got me across the finish line. It was about stamina. It was about resilience. It was about perseverance. That is a very important lesson that I learned, and hopefully that I have been able to continue to apply. So there's my story.
That's amazing. And, you know, it must have made it that much sweeter when you came back and you got it done.
Yeah, it was sweet.
The expectation too, right? That it's kind of a formality and you come, yeah, that must have been really tough. What was the best piece of business or life advice you have ever received?
Well, I'll take you to one that this really sticks out in my mind. This came from one of my professors. He said, and I truly believe this is true. He said that the most important thing that you can learn in school is how to learn when you get out of school. And I have found I now have enough years since being in school that I believe he was right. And so it's really about developing an aggressive, self-directed learning mentality and mindset that will give you a very big ROI as you go through personal and professional life. So I would cite that as a piece of advice that I think was true. And I have confirming evidence of that these years later. And I think it's very valuable.
I think that's such a fantastic lesson that, you know, we could teach today's students, you know, in terms of what is it when you leave this institution that you can take with you, you know, despite the ever-changing economy and demands and all these, what are the key core, you know, formational lessons that will help you? That's terrific.
Yeah, the more dynamic the environment, the more that principle is true.
Yeah.
Because all of your knowledge is going in and your skills are going into an obsolescence cycle. You've got to have that approach.
That's a mindset. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you have a teacher or mentor growing up that had an influence on your life?
I've had several. One that I could share with you is that I was a member of the Boy Scouts when I was a kid. And I had a scout master that taught me a very simple principle. He said, leave it better than you found it. And wherever we would go, whatever we would do, if we'd go on a camp out, it didn't matter. We would always make it a point to leave it better than we found it. That really goes back to the fundamental distinction between being a consumer and being a contributor. And I really think that this is important in life, and that we need to walk away from any interaction, any experience that we've had, and be able to say, I was a net contributor rather than I was a net consumer.
You're here. Tim, if you were invited to a dinner party and you could invite just two people from history, alive or dead today, who would you invite and why?
Two people from history. I would really like to talk to Charlemagne, who was the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, because I'd like to understand how he ticked and what motivated him to do what he did.
Interesting choice.
Yeah. And then I'm a Christian, so I would love to be able to speak to Jesus of Nazareth to understand a little bit more. I would love to be able to have a conversation.
That would be a nice dinner party.
Yes, it would.
Very interesting.
So one person I have ultimate respect for, the second. The first one, I don't, and that's why I would like to sit down with him and try to understand his motivation for conquest. So one of the things that I talk about in the book, I think it's even in the preface, Thomas, is the one thing that we have not, we are technologically advanced as a species, we are sociologically primitive as a species. Where does this instinct for conquest come from, and how can we get rid of this so that we can have truly inclusive environments? So that's why I want to have that conversation.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Brings me back to your book as well, too, when you make that point that you say that we talk a lot about intelligence these days, artificial intelligence, but you're stressing that the most important factor for being a successful business leader today is emotional and social intelligence.
I think so. And the reason that I say that, Thomas, is because I see emotional intelligence as your delivery system. You may have exceptionally high EQ and knowledge and skills and abilities. That's great, but you have to deliver that. And so your emotional intelligence is the conduit of your influence. It's your delivery system. So the EQ delivers the IQ. Therefore, it is of vital importance.
Oh, that's really well put. Yeah. And you created something. Is it called the EQ meter? Is
that EQometer?
EQometer. Yes. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's an international survey platform that with a validated emotional intelligence instrument that we use around the world.
Oh, excellent. And is that kind of play into the principles developed by Daniel Goldman?
It's based on emotional intelligence as a construct that goes back to Peter Salovey and Jack Mayer, who published really the first serious research article on the topic back in 1990. And then it's just based on the research literature since then, including Goldman as well. Yes.
Okay. I'll have to take a look at that. Sounds really interesting. Well, Tim, I am mindful of the time and I want to wrap up the podcast today with one final question. And that is, what do you think your work can teach a society like Denmark?
I hope that my work can help a society, number one, take stock of itself. So where are we? Let's talk about self-awareness in a broader sense. How about at a national level or a societal level? Until self-awareness goes to a higher level, we don't comprehend our own position. We have no bearing points to make cumulative progress. So I hope my work is helpful in this case, in this context, to help Danish society understand where it is in its progression. So accurately take stock of where it is and then be able to chart the course forward and to say, for example, how do we become a truly more inclusive environment? How do we integrate even more effectively than we are now? I think those are probably some pretty valid questions.
I can tell you they are. Yes.
Okay. Okay. I know they are in American society. I know they are. And there's a level of humility and intellectual honesty that we need in order to be able to understand where we are, to baseline our current position and then chart the course forward. I think that's very, very important. So if I can contribute to that in some small part, then I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Well, Tim, as I've mentioned, I think it's a fantastic work. And, you know, if it can help an organization or a society have the courage to be a little bit introspective in terms of where they're at, in terms of inclusion and integration, I think it's for the benefit of all parties. And I really appreciate you taking the time to call in today.
I appreciate the opportunity. I really do, Thomas. Thanks very much for the chance to be on the show.
Absolutely. And consider this an open invitation. If you ever want to explore your familial roots in Denmark, you're welcome to catch up again in Copenhagen.
Thank you very much.
Well, to our audience, don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear today, please continue to download, rate, review. It really makes a difference. And until next time, see you on the GDP.
Are you getting the most out of your time in Denmark? Pick up the printed copy of the English language newspaper Copenhagen Post today to access relevant news and event information, guaranteed to enhance your working and family life.